Welcome to the Fearless Podcast. In a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. All right, y'all, welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. This is episode 16, The Controlled Demolition of the Grand Theft World. And I am absolutely super pumped to introduce y'all, for any of y'all that aren't aware of Chris Emery and who Chris Emery is and what he has done. Chris is the producer of three absolutely incredible documentaries. His first one was A Noble Lie. That's about the Oklahoma City bombing. Second was State of Mind, The Psychology of Control. And third is Shadow Ring. And I'm really looking forward to getting to talk to Chris, ask him some questions, learn more about him. Chris, welcome to the Fearless Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor. It's been been very blessed to have a flurry of radio interviews these last 2 days. So thank you.
Well, Chris, just to get started and for the audience to get to learn a little bit more about you, how did you get involved in the whole documentary? How did you end up becoming involved in the documentary process?
Well, it started way back high school. I was a photographer with the yearbook staff. And then after high school, I started my own business as a freelance photographer with Big Ten football. Did a handful of NFL games, but it was much easier to work with college level football. And through the 8.5 years I was on the sidelines, both on the road and at home, with the University of Wisconsin and Madison, I became good friends with several media colleagues in radio, television, and film, and their work had always intrigued me. So I had the opportunity to work for a small CBS affiliate in the local market, and was with them off and on, part-time for about 4 years. And I've got a really good insight as far as network news and really how, even back then, it wasn't all cut up to be. The truth was very elusive on the news, most of the news, except for sports. That was,
right,
that was one of the few venues that they actually hit it on the mark. But it got to the point where I could see the through the illusion of it all, and they told my station manager and program director that I needed to make a change. I submitted my resignation and started working in front of the camera, print work, did some runway, a little bit of fashion work, but mainly print and commercial work. And then slowly my agent, very good agents in Madison and Milwaukee and Chicago, got me on to do bit parts in commercials, regional, and some national work. And then that's when I really saw how the production basically taken the 5,000 foot view, and seeing how all of the production and the project management comes together. And, even back in when I was in college, I was in engineering as an undergrad for 2 years. So you always had to see the bigger picture on projects. And I kind of carried that mentality and that way of approaching work with me in behind the camera and in front of the camera. And it was amazing. I was very blessed. Never went to film school formally, but you learned on the set. And after almost 12 years of working in front of and behind the camera, I decided to go on to the production side and started out at a small studio in Fort Worth. We did biographical documentaries and training videos and commercials. And then had the opportunity to move to Oklahoma City and really dig into the Oklahoma City bombing case. So it's the rest is history, as they say. Altogether, this last January 10th, it marked my 42nd year in the industry, off and on. So it's been a long time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is great.
It doesn't seem like 42 years.
I really got to thank you. Just a little bit of history and background on myself. When Oklahoma City bombing happened, that was 1995. I was in community college. I was still living at home, and it was a turning point for me, because I remember watching the news, and the thing that kids and younger people don't have a comprehension of is like the major television networks like 3, 6, and 10 or whatever it was. Right. And there wasn't this, well, actually at that time that maybe there just started to be this perpetual news cycle.
It was CNN, but, you know, CNN had a bureau in Oklahoma City for 90 days to cover the case. It was really very peculiar. I've never saw them have a bureau in a particular city like that for a short amount of time. Go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, so I still remember I was living at home. I was going to community college. We were watching it on the news. And that night, you know, it was the 8 o'clock news back then. And it was on. And I remember just as I was going to bed, they were announcing, oh, they had to stop the rescue efforts. There were other explosive devices found. They needed to clear that. And I remember going to bed and I remember waking up the next morning and asking my mom and dad, what did they say? I think I got up, went to college. I came back and I'm like, hey, what did they say about these extra explosive devices? Like, what's going on? And they were like, that's weird. They haven't mentioned anything about it again. And so I experienced that in real time, that cover up. Mm-hmm. And I remember having that in my mind and like, something isn't right here. And then I can't exactly remember the first time I saw your first documentary, Noble Lie. And I was like, and of course you cover that and tons of other incredible information, things. And I want to thank you because one of the thing about your works is your works. And this may sound weird to some people, but your works do not include like large amounts of cursing and whatnot. They're incredibly family friendly. The topics are very disturbing. Okay. But I mean, that's the way reality in life is, but they're not like inundated with cursing. And so it gives me the ability to share it with my children. We can watch it together as a family. We can learn together. And because what always has kind of bothered me is, you know, as you're when you're sharing information from guys like G. Edward Griffin, you know, and he interviewed Yuri Bezmenov, and they explain this whole deconstruction of Western society by decaying the morality, right? And then we can't expose that and simultaneously participate in it at the same time. And I really appreciate the effort that you put in to make your material friendly for all ages so that we can share these artifacts with other people. And that is not very common in today and age. And I wanted to really thank you for that. And well, I have sat down. I sat down with my older kids and we can watch it. I'm like, hey, we can watch this, get some great information. And I don't have to worry about, you know, them being exposed to anything that I don't want them to be. And then that also frees me up to share it with other families. And this way the information can get out there without, you know, this extra stuff that just, you know, that there was a day and time in America when there was an amount of decorum where even men, whether they cursed or not, they would say, hey, women and children are present. We don't do that.
Right.
You know, there was a
company. Yeah. Knock it off. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there was a amount of decency that just part of this deconstruction process that is completely gone. So that makes me appreciate your work that much more. It's incredibly thorough. It's information packed. Everything is very well cited. So I did want to say thank you very much for your service.
Well, it's funny you mention that because when we were going into post-production, we were looking over our interview notes and oddly enough, there were a few interviews. One of them we had to cut out because it was a retired law enforcement agent from the federal ranks and he was pretty salty on his language. And I told the guys, I said, hey, you know, we're not going to get an official rating from the MPAA, but let's keep this at least PG, you know, good for kids, because that's the whole purpose of our film. So thank you for bringing that out. There's very few people would even catch something like that. And I remember we really sweated it out and we had to redo some of our interviews, even on location. It says, all right, let's do this again, but try to keep out the strong words. So
you
actually brought that up.
Yeah, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate it, because the only way you're going to get the information out there is to make it ubiquitous, to be able to share it. And there's no reason, sure. It doesn't add anything to it to offend people or to,
right.
All it does is it halts the message. So I appreciate the additional effort that it takes to do that. And the other thing that is really, and maybe you can shed some light on this, is the way that your three documentaries are stacked is rather incredible, because first you expose the Oklahoma City bombing, and we see the nefarious kind of deep state aspect to that and the inner workings between the different deep state agents, the FBI and all these other governmental organizations and, government employees and elected officials. And what's very timely about all of that is one of the individuals you cover in A Noble Lie is Merrick Garland, who is currently in the news. And I want to touch on that. But, the way that Noble Lie is fleshed out and then you follow it up with State of Mind, and each documentary basically builds on the previous one, setting up this larger picture. In my opinion, it's almost like a trilogy. And I don't know if that was your intention or.
We originally wanted to go for five movies. We were able to get three. And then, for personal reasons, the analogy is that film crews are a lot like rock bands. You can work with each other so long, and then people move on. They want to start a family. They want to move out of state or whatever. So that's where, that's pretty much 90% of the reason why we pretty much went on neutral at three for now. But I've got several more. In fact, I've got two scripts behind me I've got to look at tonight before I go to bed. But yes, again, very insightful the way you brought that up. The reason we made State of Mind, Psychology of Control was that after we released our first film, which was December of 2011, within about 6 weeks, we were getting emails from all over St. Petersburg, Russia, Moscow, Sydney, Australia, the Philippines, and all points in between Oklahoma City, Canada, Mexico. And we were getting high schools in Canada and Mexico and junior colleges all over North America wanting to screen our film. And we were like a deer in the headlights, and it dawned on us like, wow, after getting these emails and saying, thank you for making the film, people were asking us, well, why were you guys the first one to come out and do this? Why weren't people asking questions? And that really got us on the track of saying, okay, literally from the day we're born till the day we die, we're controlled either with media, education, nutrition, governmental edicts, both covert and overt, subliminal advertising. And that had a lot to do with people accepting the official stock answer of Oklahoma City. And, people are there just trying to earn a living and they've got kids, and a lot of folks didn't have the time to step back and say, hey, not only didn't this make sense, and here are the reasons why. So that was the impetus for State of Mind, Psychology of Control. And then the third one, The Shadow Ring. In fact, I've got both books here by James Perloff, who helped us co-write and direct the film. And he helped us through the post-edit. we took the time frame from at the Spanish-American War, when the bombing of the USS Maine and Havana Harbor, to right before 9/11. We didn't want to touch upon 9/11 because a lot of our colleagues did an absolutely fantastic job with that. So no use revisiting that on a filmmaker standpoint. Mm-hmm. So there we were. And by halfway through the second film, we had the business model down where, you do your pre-production, the principal, and then your post. And we had a cycle of about a year and a half to turn them out. And we were just on that track to really kick it into gear. And then things changed and you just got to work with change. So, but I've got, like I said, at least two projects and another two behind that. So it's a matter of getting funding and, you got to tell the people, it's like, okay, let's be realistic. This is going to be about a year to a year and a half before we can actually monetize this thing. So that's, you're giving birth to a film, so to speak. So.
Yeah. And why I think this is so critical and important, and one, the information is voluminous by stacking these three documentaries in succession, but two, it builds this whole, it dissolves this whole illusion of partisan politics, Republicans, Democrats, and it shows this the deep state like infiltration, but facilitation, right? You know, our channel's about lots of different things, and we try to be self-sufficient, self-reliant. We try to grow our own food. We try to educate.
By the way, I want to commend you. The quality of your programming is awesome. I got a chance to really do a little deep dive in your work, and it's keep up the great work. I like it.
You're doing great. We appreciate that. That's a lot coming from you. You really offer a high quality product, and thank you very much for that. We're going to continue. My son is very much is into audio, video, sound, lighting, and just wants to continue to grow what he's doing there. And he's all self-taught on the job, very similar to yourself. So he really appreciated the documentaries. And but Bill, once you come out of this state of mind control of propaganda, once you're cleared of that, you know, we can find solutions. And, you know, my personal opinion is that there isn't a political solution. There's a personal solution, and you have to attack each one of these issues on a personal, a familial level, on your family level, with your children, on your community level, you know, and we're creating these parallel society, parallel community, parallel economy, whether it's through, you know, local community and meetups, you know, where we're doing different events to grow community, to share information, to educate, to encourage, you know, all these things are so important.
Homeschool. Yeah.
Homeschooling. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. We've homeschooled all of our children from the beginning. And this is another great resource, because one question that we get all the time is like, well, what historical, because me and my wife, we both went to government schools. So we learned all the victors' writings of, you know, we learned the government school rendition of who Abraham Lincoln was and how he saved the Union and all that stuff, all the way down the line. So we get asked all the time, what type of resources, where are your resources? And I mean, your trilogy is an excellent resource for the expose of government, deep state, international banking cartels, and how all of these transnational corporations, CFR, all of these extra governmental organizations and this hierarchical structure, you know, how they have postmodernly reconstructed our history to build a narrative that has paved the road to where we are today. To everything with, you know, transgenderism to all this postmodern critical race theory. This has all been set in place by all the people that you expose here in the three documentaries. It's an incredible resource as a historical reference point for homeschooling families to review with their children, show them, you know, when it's age appropriate. You don't need your 8-year-old does not need to be worrying about the banking cartel, you know, the international banking cartel.
Right.
But, you know,
first you walk, then you crawl, walk, and run, as they say. You're right. Yeah.
Yep. But when you do get into this to history and real history and how it applies, I mean, it's a perfect time for a high school aged person to be exposed to this and learn this and learn what these different high marks, you know, being in government school and reading the government textbooks, you know, we have a totally different understanding of what the causes were for World War I, World War II, the Cuban Missile Crisis, all these different things. And you've connected so many dots. And I know that in State of Mind, you worked very closely with Richard Grove. And that was actually the purpose. Yeah, the purpose of my title, The Controlled Demolition of the Grand Theft World. Richard has a weekly podcast called Grand Theft World, and it's very long form, and it's very information packed. But that was part of my title, was a hat tip to Richard, because I know he was instrumental in State of Mind. I think he was also involved in Noble Lie.
Well, not so much on the Noble Eye, but let me give you an interesting twist. The title of our film is actually, the full title is The Noble Eye, Oklahoma City, 1995. Richard, through serendipity or synchronicity, whatever, he actually produced a movie called A Noble Eye. And I believe it was out before our film came out. So I tactfully have to correct some of the folks when they do the intro. But here's the wild thing, that not only did he produce that film, but we brought him on as an interviewee. We thought, wow. And we had a wish list of 37. I think we were able to land about 27 people. And I think we got 23 in the final cut. So, but the thing with Richard is that, again, this is where the first guy that pretty much decided he needed to go his own way, that was with us on her first film. I'm not going to name names out of respect, but he wasn't able to finish his what we hired him for on a contractual basis to write for the film. Richard stepped in and just took the baton and just ran with it. I mean, he knocked it out of the park for us. And I could say unequivocally, if it wasn't for Richard Grove and his wife, who really did an amazing job of narrating that film, it was his fiance at the time, Lisa Urbicheski, we would have not gotten that film out if it wasn't for those two. And he stepped in. And I want to go back and say that we were guided by, on a spiritual level. People have different, you know, deities or whatever they choose to worship. I was raised in the Christian background. But there were a couple of guys on the crew that were agnostic. They didn't necessarily believe in any higher power. But what we experienced, especially in the first film and the second, after the second one, they said, yeah, there's something that a good power that was leading us in the right direction on this, because we wanted to do good. And I'm not being sappy or cliche here, but it's true. I mean, how many times have we needed money, or we needed equipment or software, or, you know, we had to have this crucial interview come through, and they were always getting no's on them. And all of a sudden, boom, the light, you know, the switch just clicked, and we were able to, everything just fell into place. That wasn't by chance. There was something that there was there. So I think you understand where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
And Richard was part of that, you know, and his fiance, Lisa. So.
Yeah. I mean, Richard is a superhuman freak of nature with his ability and his mind and his research. And he has that, that mind map that connects all of these different people and all these historical events with hyperlinks. And yeah, he is an incredible historian, and he does excellent work. It was really neat to see that he was involved in State of Mind, because I appreciate the work that he does.
He has our DVD cover on his set. If you look on the set, he's probably still displaying our State of Mind DVD. I think it's still in the cellophane wrap. Every time I see a show, it's like, wow. Now that's a huge honor. To look back, how many years, you know, Richard and I have kind of gone in different directions, but I still have the utmost respect for his work. Yeah, it's amazing. And we're very proud to have our DVD displayed on his set when he does his show. Next time you watch it, it should be right there. I think it's left of center from his side. So,
okay, great. Right. I will look for that. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Merrick Garland's involvement with Oklahoma City bombing in light of, you know, modern day, where Merrick Garland is, maybe why Merrick Garland is, if you want to speak to that at all, Chris.
Well, we'll go in depth here a little bit, but if people want a more broader perspective on our website, and I may suggest if you scroll three quarters of the way down, our webmaster was kind enough to embed, it's an MP3 file. I think it's a 28-minute interview I had in three segments in studio with Oren Shore with InfoWars last July. So we're talking over a year ago. And that's a really good synopsis. Owen knocked it out of the park there too. He was very humbled to be able to come into his studio. And also a big shout out to the InfoWars crew. If it wasn't for them, we wouldn't have been able to release our two films to the massive worldwide market that we did. So we always be very grateful to them. But getting back to Merrick Garland, okay, so he was appointed as a special U.S. prosecutor by the Justice Department to investigate and prosecute the Oklahoma City bombing, McVeigh and Nichols, and then basically others unknown. Well, within about a month, they dropped the others unknown. They chose not to go after anybody. Michael Fortier was an accomplice, but Fortier turned state's evidence and basically rolled on both McVeigh and Nichols, and he perjured himself 18 times on the stand. So his testimony, his credibility was down the toilet when we watched the the video archive of the trial and read the transcript, and it's just like, wow, yeah, they told this guy to lie, 12 ways this side of Sunday. So that was at the behest of Merrick Garland. Louis Freeh was the head of the FBI at the time. And interestingly enough, and a lot of people don't know this, but it was number two under Louis Freeh. And also, there's no way that Merrick Garland would not have been aware of this, is that Larry Potts, number two under Louis Freeh, was McVeigh's handler for at least 4 months before the bombing. Now, let that sink in for a few minutes. McVeigh had a handler with the FBI to lead him in the direction and instruct him on what to do in the months, the weeks, and the days, and the hours, and the minutes before Oklahoma City took place. That never came out in federal court, either in the McVeigh or the Nichols trial. Why? Because Merrick Garland, and this is after a meeting I had with Tim McVeigh's former lead defense counsel, Stephen Jones, at his office, at his law office in Enid, Oklahoma, which was an hour and a half drive northwest of downtown Oklahoma City, right almost on the Kansas-Oklahoma border. And what Stephen Jones told me, it was supposed to be about an hour meeting. I had five questions to ask him. He did not want to go on camera, and that was fine. We were doing background interviews at the time, and he chose not to be in the film. Again, we respected that. He was running late signing papers on a couple of cases while I was in the waiting room outside of where his receptionist was. And he came out, he was very apologetic, and he said, look, I don't like to wait for my clients, so I'm certainly not going to have you wait for me. He says, you have the rest of the evening with me. So for the next 3.5 hours, he walked me through on what Merrick Garland did and chose not to do with this case. And I'll never forget this. Stephen Jones is left-handed, had those signature, you remember the thick glasses, the lens glasses that he had? And he wrote a line right down the middle of this long, it was 11-inch legal pad. And he says, Chris, he says, I'm going to tell you what this case is and what it's not. And almost immediately he told me Merrick Garland spent 3.5 months pleading with the presiding judge that officiated over both the McVeigh and the Nichols trial, Richard Mache, based in Denver. And he said that Merrick Garland pleaded with the judge for over 3.5 months to quash over 90% of the exculpatory evidence and not present it to either federal jury in those trials. And I was just shocked. I said, well, wait a minute, that makes no sense. He was, special U.S. prosecutor. And he says, yeah, that trial for McVeigh alone was supposed to last between 4 and 4.5 months. It lasted 3.5 weeks. Why? Wow. Because Merrick Garland, without a shadow of a doubt, cut off all the pegs of the foundation of what Stephen Jones in his case, what they were going to present. There were 12 to 18 people involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. McVeigh was working for the CIA, what we know for sure, for almost 2 years. And Nichols was set up. The prosecution and the Justice Department manufactured over 70% of the evidence. They just made it up out of whole cloth. It was horrendous.
Yeah.
And their case was so flimsy on basically going ahead. McVeigh was tried, and his verdict was read on June of 97. Then, Nichols was brought in, I believe, in October of 97, and the final verdict was like 2 days before Christmas, and he was sentenced the following January of 98. So they had a fast track on both of these trials. Merrick Garland had an integral part in making sure that there was selective prosecution, that the exculpatory evidence was never presented to the jury trial or the trial juries, and it was so bad in the Nichols trial that they came one jury member short of exonerating Nichols of all charges. That's how weak their case was.
Wow.
So that's when I found out that Merrick Garland was going to be brought before the Senate for confirmation hearings as a attorney general. It took me 3 days to calm down. I was just beyond myself. I couldn't believe it. I says, this guy, for what he did on the Oklahoma City case alone, and how they spent, by the way, we found out from Stephen Jones, he gave us full and unfettered access to 142 boxes of legal documents that he had accumulated during discovery process leading up to the first day of the federal trial for McVeigh. And out of those 142 boxes, 20 of them dealt with just what they call the billables of the financials. We found out how much the defense team spent and billed the Justice Department and how much the prosecution spent and billed it. And the prosecution spent just shy of $69 million to completely destroy any credibility on the prosecution in that case. And wow. Stephen Jones spent just a little more than $28 million. He had private eyes flying all over the world. Now, why would you do that if it was just two lone nuts blowing up an AMPO truck in front of the building? No.
Right.
He had mullahs. He had connections with, indigenous tribes in Jordan, former terrorists in Ireland, in the Shining Path and down to South America, former terrorists out of Italy. All of them were contacting him and say, hey, we know where certain elements of these explosives came. 23 devices in the building, two had gone off, and the other 21 had not. They knew. I mean, that was their job as terrorists at the time, before they were incarcerated. And they were just stumbling over themselves to help Stephen Jones. Merrick Garland did not want any of that information to come out in any of the trials. Can you imagine?
I think you can make a really good case. Probably a large part of that is why he has the position he has today. Yeah. You know,
and what he's doing. Yep.
Yeah. When you play your role and you play your part well, you get rewarded. You get the money, you get the influence, you get the power. And that is in large part of where he is and why he is where he is today. And I mean, retrospectively, thinking of what's currently going on and J6 and all these different things that he is presiding over and directly influencing. And then you also take the fact of McVeigh having a handler, right? And the whole Elohim City thing and all of this deep state involvement, whether it's FBI, whether it's CIA, and how it's, what we've learned from the Governor Whitmer kidnapping is basically how 9 out of every 10 white Nazi extremists are all like covertly working for the deep state or whatever, basically illustrating that the predominance of this, these homegrown terrorists are basically just kind of Blackwater apparitions that are funded and facilitated by our government against the citizens.
You know what the irony is, though? Here we are. We're looking back. We rewind the tape 28 years, over 28 years now, this April 19th of this year. And the irony is that, so here we go. Vice President Gore at the time in the White House with Bill Clinton requested from the chief of staff, from Helmut Kohl of Germany. His chief of staff was Gunther Strassmeier. And they made arrangements for a washout from the special services, Gunther Strassmeier's son, Andreas, to come over and infiltrate alleged neo-Nazi groups in the U.S. Well, they didn't exist, or very little. They didn't have any influence. They just wanted to doctor this up and concoct it all out of thin air. So Strassmeier shows up and actually infiltrated himself in LM City with elements from the CIA, the FBI, and the ATF. And they didn't even know their own operatives were at the LM City. It was so compartmentalized. There were ego wars, turf wars. They wanted the budget to create cases to justify an inflated, bloated budget for the next congressional 2-year term. So my point is that Andreas Strassmeier, we found out, oh gosh, through some of the members of what they call the Texas Light Brigade. They were in the militia, but they used motocross motorcycles. And, they had a good intention, but they were kind of a haphazard, loosely assembled group of militia. They saw Andreas Strassmeier entering the federal courthouse in downtown Fort Worth. This is about 2.5 months before the Oklahoma City bombing, punching a security code into the keypad in the loading dock in the back of the and they basically said, you got 24 hours to get out of the state of Texas or you may end up face down in a ditch with a couple of gunshots in the back of your head. And so they scared the hell out of him, and then where does he end up? In LOM City. And then he starts a whole ball rolling and instigating all of the goading on and the planning of what would eventually become the horrendous Oklahoma City bombing. So that's what we have. That's the handiwork of Al Gore and the Clinton administration. We know that the cover-up and the malfeasance of the Oklahoma City case not only goes from Oklahoma City, but it goes to the steps of the White House, without a doubt. Absolutely without a doubt. People still need to be prosecuted. Of course, there is no statute of limitations on murder.
And corresponding to that, right, in the Murrah building was all the white or large portions of the Whitewater documents, correct?
We... we were told that that was the case. We couldn't find any solid evidence. We knew that the CIA had documents in there, and we found that out from, oddly enough, the FBI absconded a brand new street sweeper from, I'll never forget talking to one of the street maintenance guys for the city of Oklahoma City. This street sweeper was literally just shipped in and still in the crate. They were putting it together. And the FBI found out that it was ready to go. They fired it up. And that's why they stopped the search and rescue, not to look for bombs or unexploded ordnance. That was the cover story. But there were sensitive documents in the building. And we got this from actually Canine Rescue, Don Browning, who we interviewed in the film. He said that he was on the south side of the plaza, which is the opposite side of the building from where that gaping hole was. And they were told there to stand there in the pouring rain for over 2 hours while the FBI and who God only knows what other agencies, some of them that we never knew even existed, were helping them get these documents. There were people in the rubble that were still alive. There were the dead. And they were reaching through and screaming, wanting people to help them. And the fire department and search and rescue were called off for over 2 hours just so these SOBs could get their documents. The next day after everything dried up, they used the street sweeper to actually go around almost two blocks around the crime scene to sweep up any loose debris and any paper that they could get their hands on. Because when that building blew up, there was a mushroom cloud, invisible mushroom cloud, that shot over 400 feet in the air, almost 40 stories high. And that literally sucked everything out of the building and just spread it like a giant sprinkler, so to speak. And it was perfectly symmetrical. And they had a 42-mile-an-hour wind kicking things up the morning of the bombing. So it was a mess for about eight blocks around that building. And so, anyway, I didn't mean to get off on a tangent, but that's stuff we found out that we simply couldn't even put in the film. We didn't have enough time.
Now, another interesting bit of information was what you found out about Muhammad Atta, who was tied directly to 9/11. Maybe you explain a little bit about that, what you found out about this correlation and overlap between the Oklahoma City bombing and 9/11 and what you uncovered.
In fact, I'm looking at my dossier here. It's hold on one second. This is what we have gathered. It's almost 4 inches thick, almost 6 inches thick. That was 3.5 years of work. All right. So the Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday morning before 9/11. 9/11 is on a Tuesday, so we rewind the tape back to the previous Thursday. There's a docent. In fact, I have here, just to let you know, there's credibility on this. This is her badge that she had with the Oklahoma City National Memorial. She gave it to me and says, I want you to keep this and remember my story and what happened. So it's the Thursday afternoon, mid-afternoon. Actually, excuse me, I'll take that back. It was in the morning because she was fired in the afternoon, if you can imagine that. Wow. I've been with the museum for almost 2 years. And let me rephrase that. She wasn't fired that day. She was fired the afternoon of 9/11 because she went in work screaming and crying to her boss saying, hey, I remember Muhammad Atta the previous Thursday. Anyway, so the Thursday, it was mid-morning. Muhammad Atta comes in with four of his accomplices, and they're speaking very boisterously. They're loud. They're not. It's a very, understated, very quiet environment in there, as you can imagine. You're trying to respect and remember the 168 people that died, including three unborn children. And these guys are carrying on like they're in a nightclub, and she finally says, "That's enough, guys. You got to take the stairwell and take the side exit. We can't have you here." And they were taken back. Being from the Middle East or their background, that women normally don't speak up to them like that. But, it's just one of those things like, no, you're in the U.S. This is how we have to respect, especially an institution like this. So that's Thursday. So the Friday afternoon, we go to Graham's Country Western Bar, which is about 4 miles west of downtown Oklahoma City from the crime scene or from the memorial. And Muhammad Atta is cited there by a bartender that I still am good friends with him to this day. And he said, Atta's in the club, looked like he was sleeping in the back of his car for 2 days, completely disheveled, his clothes were a wrinkled mess, but he remembers that ashen, stone-cold look on his face. like he was on something, you know, it just, things weren't quite right. And as a bartender, you have a pretty good eye of people that you want in the club, and you know who's going to probably cause some problems. And so Atta pulls a knife on one of the patrons who was with the girlfriend, and there was another couple with this patron. And patron says, "Hey, I'm just here dancing, you know." And so new manager lets Atta and his four accomplices stay in the bar, and he kicks out the patrons who were longtime customers. His bartender knew them. Again, that's a red flag. So that's Friday. And then let's see here. Saturday night, they come back, and the bartender really had his radar up, and he says, "All right, no more pulling knives." And so the guys order five shots of whiskey. They requested a Dewar's. They didn't serve that, so we gave them an off-brand well whiskey at $3 a shot. Now, I have a copy of the receipt that's $15. And again, the bartender, another red flag, he stiffed. Muhammad Atta stiffed the bartender, didn't give him a tip, not even a cash tip. All right, another red flag. This is the flag number three. The expiration date on that American Express credit card that was used on that bar tab for 15 measly dollars had expired at the end of March. Now, how in the world do you run a card that expires in March in the first, second week of September? Doesn't make any sense.
No.
That bartender said he'd been working there for over 18 years. He said he just passed his 18-year anniversary, I think that August. And he says he's never been able to run a card that's expired. That was the first time. All right, the final and the fourth red flag. So this 9/11 is on a Tuesday. That following Saturday, a fifth accomplice of alleged accomplice that was on the headshots of the 19 hijackers comes into the bar that following Saturday. Is one of my colleagues yesterday was in an interview. He says, "Yeah, that's a tear in the matrix. Something is really odd. This is way beyond Twilight Zone." He comes into the bar and picks a fight with his bartender friend of mine. And he got all riled up because a couple other patrons, unbeknownst to who this guy was, they didn't have a clue, were talking about 9/11. So this fifth accomplice got upset, and the bartender pushes him away. And he remembers he saw him literally within 8 inches of his face, grabbing the scruff of his neck, pushes him away. He says, "What the hell's your problem?" He says, "Some of my friends were killed and on that 9/11. And I think there may have been a news story or something on one of the TVs up on the wall that was, you know, recounting what happened that previous Tuesday. And sure enough, he went back and saw the headshots, got on the internet and pulled up the color headshots of the hijackers, and he was one of them. So there were Muhammad Atta and five other guys that came through that bar, one of them the Saturday after. And as a film crew, it's like, all right, how did this get dropped in our lap? Well, we're talking beginning of 2006. One of the producers from InfoWars, who was on, worked before Rob Dew, Rob did a great job, but it was his predecessor. For a year and a half, was consistently contacted by this bartender. He says, I got this story I need to tell you. I've got affidavits. I've got eyewitness testimony. I have documentation." He had sketches of where these guys were, and that there were three dance floors in that institution. And as a bartender and a backup bouncer, you got to know the place inside and out. He knew it like the back of his hand. Anyway, he kept contacting this producer, and finally the producer calls me and says, "Look, we know you guys are working on the Oklahoma City case, but can you at least talk to this bartender?" And he gave me the name and the phone number, explained the situation. I said, "Yeah, we'll go over there. We'll be there maybe half hour, 45 minutes. Just want to be courteous." We walked out 4.5 hours later, and we were stunned at the thorough documentation that he had and the receipt. And I vetted his testimony with some other bartenders and also the bar back and another bartender that was there, and it was solid. And every time we sat down, and the story did not change one iota. He wasn't making things up. So the cherry on the icing and the cake for us was to be able to, we contacted, this is the gal that helped us vet some of our contacts with the federal government that was helping us, retired FBI and one Secret Service agent, a retired CIA agent that was helping us in Oklahoma City. I said, "Look, can you do us a favor? We've got all but the last four digits of this credit card." And she figured out it was American Express. Work for the Secret Service, they know how to get answers. You know, that's their job. Mm-hmm. White collar crime, whatever, counterfeit. She found out that this expired American Express credit card with the expiration date at the end of March of 2001 was based out of a bank in Malta, which is off the coast of Sicily. And there were only three account holders in the bank. The CIA, MI6, which is the British counterpart to the CIA, and Israeli intelligence. So Mohammed Atta had his $15 tab paid on an expired American Express credit card from one of these intelligence agencies. And we're sitting there as a film crew. It's like, holy heck, how the heck did we, you know, get in the position to even look at this stuff? And I thanked my contact, and she told me, Chris, please, you know, with all due respect, don't ever call me again. She was retired. She'd been away out of Washington for about a year, living a comfortable life in West Fort Worth, out in the country. And she says, my ex-bosses in Washington, D.C. blew a gasket when they found out I wanted to look into this. They got themselves tore up one side and down the other in Washington by helping her out. And she says, we threw up so many red flags on that. She says, please don't ever ask me to do anything like this again. Came within, you know, pretty close to losing her pension over the whole thing. That's how sensitive it was.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, as Alex on InfoWars says, you can't make this stuff up. I mean, this is, you know, in Mohammed Atta, we know he was at a linguistic school in Monterey, California, knew six different languages fluently. Alex had interviewed the sergeant that taught him a couple of those languages. And, you know, then he had a apartment that had an address just outside of the Pensacola Naval Air Station in Florida. We knew that he was in going through airman flight school in south of Oklahoma City for at least a year and a half before the Oklahoma City or before 9/11. We blew that. In fact, our film crew approached, I hope I'm not running on here. I'm just trying to tell you, this is stuff that had nothing to do with the Oklahoma City case at all, but they, you know, there was the overlap. This was, it would have been right after we released that article and all this information on the sighting and the bartender and the receipt. It was July of 2008. So it would have been August and early September. Finally, I think in September, we approached the Oklahoma Gazette, which is one of many alliance of independent newspapers in Austin. They have the Austin Chronicle, Oklahoma Gazette, and Oklahoma City. And we approached the senior editor of the Oklahoma Gazette, who I knew as a former speechwriter for Frank Keating, who, oddly enough, was the governor at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing. Phil Bachrach was his name. Very, very good guy. He took a measured approach to helping us out, but he knew that we did our homework. You know, we did our due diligence. And so he was kind enough to help us promote. He gave us a very objective review of our film in his paper after it was released. But going back several years before that to break the story, he hired out an independent writer from an independent paper in Tulsa. He was only, I believe, on the staff for about 2 weeks. And he brought him into the boardroom, our five guys in our film crew, and Phil and this new writer. We're going to put together at least a three, if not a five-part series on this story. We were all excited. We gave him everything, copies of what we had, and said, look, you've got to run with this. Well, I ran into that writer 2 days later, and he was fired. And I said, what happened? He says, yeah, they didn't want me to touch the story. Evidently, and we found out later through other channels, the FBI field office in Oklahoma City put the lid on that whole thing. You know, the old saying goes, you get too close to the sun, you get burned. Well, we found out the FBI was sitting on this same, almost identical information we had, almost verbatim, for 5.5 years. They did nothing. Here we come along as an independent film crew, and we're ready to inadvertently, we upstage them. We just said, you know, it's like, okay, we got the story. Let's get it out. Now, no go. So that's the 9/11 connection to Oklahoma City.
So in light of this information about Atta being some type of deep state asset, whether he was CIA or he was obviously an asset of some deep state entity, when it comes to Timothy McVeigh, your personal opinion, do you think that he was executed, or did you think that?
Good question.
No, okay.
Without a doubt, I don't think he was. And the one contact that we had, and the reason being is, and we've been asked that, good question, we've been asked that many times over the years. And Paul Craig, or W. Craig Roberts, former investigator with the Tulsa Police Department, who we interview in both our first and second film, we've both been on the same interviews, radio interviews, and both of us without even skipping a beat. When that answer question is asked, we just say no. Why? Because the CIA contact that we had that helped us said, look, if you're going to execute your assets, set them up to fail like that, you're going to have a hell of a time recruiting. I mean, that line is going to dry up really quick. I mean, it's just common sense.
Yeah.
So why would you set your asset up, you know, to roll, and you don't kill them off like that? So we think that he went in, not the standard, you know, what they call that, witness protection, but there's a whole nother level of that for the intelligence agencies, if you can imagine that, you know, it's just much more secretive. And that, we think that's where McVeigh is now. And another reason I say that is, and I found this out from Terry Nichols' brother, James Nichols, that he actually befriended Tim McVeigh's birth dad, who had the legal right to get the remains of Tim McVeigh from the death chamber in Terre Haute, Indiana. He said the morning of the execution, they said that McVeigh was still breathing. He was still respirating when they pulled a sheet over his face and drew the curtains and where he was in the gurney in the death chamber. But there were three hearses in the back of the facility, and they all drove in different directions to throw the media off. Mm-hmm. So McVeigh sued for the remains. That was his son. That was his blood. You know, he helped bring into this world as a baby. And the warden said no. They handed him an urn full of ashes. Well, that could have been somebody's dog. We don't know.
Of course.
You know, that's how disrespectful and callous is that? So those two things right there, it's like, nah. I'm at least 90% sure that he's still alive somewhere right now.
Wow. Yeah, that was my opinion. And my personal opinion on the whole Jeffrey Epstein thing, I think that he's been reallocated as well. Sure. That's just my opinion. But, that's a classic example. You know, people always say, all this conspiracy, how do they cover it up? Well, you're demonstrating how they cover it up. The lengths they go to, the depths they go to, and then how these people that are critically involved in the process continue to rise to the cream of the crap of the top. You know, guys like Merrick Garland now, who have served their masters, and you know, they rise in the ranks, and you know, and it's all part of the pay to play game, and you get rewarded when you serve the deep state, and that's what's going on here. But this has been, I really appreciate your time. This has been a ton of fun getting to talk to you, pick your brain a little bit. I greatly appreciate what you're doing. Could you share, what I'll do is I'll pull up your website, and if you could share with how people can best find your material.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And by the way, let me insert this real quick. I want to, and I try to say this on any presentation or interview, we had amazing help from local, county, state, and federal law enforcement. If it wasn't for them, we would have not been able to release this film, almost on the same level as how Richard Grove stepped up for us. But these people put their lives, their pensions, their sanity on the line sometimes to help us. So I want to make sure that people understand there's a lot of very good people within law enforcement and civil and professional, employees of the government. It's the bad that we have to keep in check. There's that yang and the yin, the balance. So to find our work, please log on to our website, freemindfilms with an S, freemindfilms.com. And there are pirated copies of them on YouTube. Please don't look on YouTube. We don't get any monetary gain from that. You can still watch them for free on our website. And But we do get monetized on the ads. And as of yesterday, good news is Paul Wittenberger with COVIDland, he's been a steady customer of ours, offering the DVD copies. People still desire to have a DVD. Yeah. You can get onto COVIDland.com on their store, and both State of Mind, Psychology of Control, and Shattering are available at COVIDland.com at his store. So both the VOD and the DVDs are available. And and if you need to contact me, if anybody has any questions, and by the way, I'm going to offer, kind of extend an offer for your son to contact me too, if he has any questions on his work, get a hold of me at my email address for the viewers at ccemery, ccemery at protonmail.com. I typically will return your email within 24 hours, respond to it.
And I can vouch for that, y'all, because Chris was on the Ripple Effect podcast with Ricky Verandas, and he gave out his email, and I'm like, ah, what the heck? I'm going to try giving shoot him in an email. And he has responded to me the same day. He's incredibly gracious, humble guy. We appreciate you. Y'all, this is a value for value proposition. If you do appreciate the resources and what we provide, please go on over to thetexasboys.com. If you're local and you're looking for some grass-fed beef, you know, we should be starting to take orders again here shortly, or check out our website for coffees or whatever else you need. Please check that out. We love and appreciate all of you. We really want to thank Chris for investing his time with us. And one last thing that I want y'all to remember, stay fearless.
God bless. Thank you.